Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am joined today by two of my amazing Bruegel colleagues. We have Francesco Papadia and Emmanuel Mourlon-Drouot, and we are going to talk about Italy. Italy is one of the EU's founding countries. It is a country that is often in the news for historically frequently changing governments and having lots and lots of outstanding government debt. And more recently, for having one of the EU's longer governments and longer in charge leaders in Giorgia Meloni, and yet also still having lots of debt and somehow never quite bringing the crisis that people have been thought about, but also never not being in people's minds for what's going to happen next. Francesco, how is the Italian economy doing? And how does this fit in the context of the last few years and before?
Answering this question requires taking a double perspective because the Italian economy has no one face. It has two faces, and they're very different from every point of view, including from an assessment point of view. I would say one is good and the other is bad. So let me clarify what I meant. The good part is the fiscal situation. Italy clearly has a flow fiscal situation that is better than France, just to make one example, because soon it will get out of the excessive deficit procedure. It has shown over the recent past reasonable behavior. In particular, the Meloni government has shown reasonable behavior. It has exited that crazy thing that was the super bonus for real estate or for dwellings. That was really something extreme and very bad. And it's showing discipline in the fiscal situation, notwithstanding the many demands that are made to the government for one or the other purpose. So that's a good part. And then there is the bad part. And just to anticipate my assessment, the bad part overwhelms the good part. And the bad part, you alluded to that already, Rebecca, is the lack of growth. Of course, the lack of growth is something that predates by decades the Meloni government. I mean, Italy basically has not grown in terms of GDP per head over the last 25 years, while every other country, or at least the large countries in the euro area, Greece is the exception, have grown over this time. Germany, maybe 25%, France 15%, Italy practically zero. And of course, this is not the fault of the Meloni government. As I said, I mean, this has been outstanding for 25 years, but you don't see any sign that the Meloni government is changing this situation. And Italy desperately needs to change this situation because Italy still has a lot of demands on its economy that are not satisfied. Poverty is an issue in Italy. You would be surprised to know that Italy spends quite a lot in terms of welfare, but there are many more people at risk of poverty in Italy than, say, in Germany or France. And that would require the Meloni government doing things that are against its nature, because this is a government that comes from an economic philosophy of intervention, protectionism, statalism. So exactly the contrary of what you would need in terms of competition, in terms of freedom, in terms of opening to the foreign sector. So there is no sign that this situation is changing. And you can understand that the situation is changing because that would require doing things that are not within the economic philosophy of this government.
Thank you very much. It's hard to get around how significant this government is. It's hard for me to get my head around it because, on the one hand, Giorgia Meloni comes from this background of working with really right-wing parties of the kind that we have not had in charge of European countries for the most part in recent times. And yet, also, she has worked very constructively at the European level to help the EU move ahead with some of its joint challenges. So there's a bit of straddling several perspectives there. Manuel, I asked you on this show today for a couple of reasons, one being that you are a very fabulous economic historian with a great new book on the history of the euro coming out, and the other being that you're teaching in Italy and have a front row seat for all of this. So how do you see the Meloni government and what should we make of it?
The Meloni government, as you were hinting at in a way, is a bit of a paradox because, as you said, it works maybe not so constructively, but at least superficially constructively in Europe, at least much more than we would have expected, given the anti-European rhetoric it has used and still uses occasionally. At the same time, that's strong change with the tradition in Italy to be much more pro-European integration in general terms. So Italy is historically, obviously, one of the founding member states of the EU, even one of the founding member states of the G7, and has a very strong tradition, a very strong current of federalists. And so the arrival to power of someone who's officially almost Eurosceptic and then turned much more constructive in power is a little bit of a paradox. And it's a paradox that has implications outside because, obviously, with the rise of the extreme right in France and the fact that it is leading in the polls, that raises the question of how extreme political parties change their rhetoric and their actions between when they campaign and once they come to power. So that's why I think we struggle to understand the situation, and it's one that is very difficult to read. One of the key examples, I think, that happened last year, illustrating the situation that our listeners may remember, was a spat with Meloni's remarks about the Ventotene manifesto. The Ventotene manifesto was one of the key documents of the beginnings of European integration, written in 1941 in the prison of Ventotene on the Ventotene Island by three famous Italians, Ernesto Rossi, Eugenio Colorni, and Altiero Spinelli. And it circulated in the resistance and became progressively a program for the European Federalist movement. And Meloni in the parliament last year had criticized it, showing and discussing excerpts of it, and in particular one which said that the authors of the manifesto were against private property. And she said, "This is not my Europe." And that actually backfired because many Italians reacted in defending the manifesto, because what Meloni missed was that actually this manifesto had become a sort of symbol of the early thinking about European integration, the development of peace, what actually it was calling for in the first place: self-determination, a spirit of criticism against authoritarian dogmatism of the authoritarian powers during the Second World War. And in a sense, that encapsulated the fact that the sort of Euroscepticism she was pushing for, anti-European positions she had, were completely running against part of what the population thinks and the symbol that Europe has for many Italians.
Francesco, what is your sense of this post-war legacy and how it is showing up in modern times?
Well, I think it's useful to start from what Emmanuel said about Meloni, because that sheds light on your question. I think Meloni, first of all, is a shrewd politician. I mean, she's clever. She knows which battles she can win and she knows which battles she cannot win. So she has understood that she cannot win the European battle. Of course, there was a gaffe, as Emmanuel said, about this speech in Parliament, but she has understood that she cannot go against Europe. I mean, she has to find a way to go along Europe, and that she does also in a relationship with Trump. I mean, she's very careful not to adopt the Trump policies against Europe while maintaining a good relationship with the American president. And so here as well, I would use the paradigm of the two faces. Meloni has two faces. You know, the Roman god Janus that had the two faces, open and closed. Meloni is like that. On the issues that she knows she cannot win, fiscal policy, clearly. I mean, she's not doing the crazy things that Salvini and Conte did. She understood there she cannot win, and so, okay, I will comply. But then on other issues, she will reveal her true views are true. And I have one very symbolic, I mean, it's not terribly important, but I think it's significant story. This is a Bolkestein directive. The Bolkestein directive 15 years ago asked for services to be liberalized. And part of this liberalization of services in Italy was that the beach concession had to be given according to tenders, while in Italy, practically they are owned by the concessionary. And this has been going on, and the Court of Justice has come in and has condemned Italy, and the Italian Administrative Court has said, no, you have to do a tender. And Italy is resisting year after year after year. And so they cannot beat one lobbying, which is not so overwhelming. I mean, yes, I mean, it's an important lobby, but I mean, the owner of concessions for beaches are not such a terrible lobby to beat. And there, she's not doing what she could do, given that she has a strong government, that she has been in government for very long. She has a strong majority, but it's just intrinsically impossible for her to be the standard bearer of competition and free competition. So I think that this is her limit. And of course, I mean, the hope is that given that she's a shrewd politician, she will understand that she has to move away from her ideological comfort zone. But it's not at all clear that she will. And the episode that Emanuele recalled of her intervention in Parliament about the Ventotene manifest goes in the direction, no, that's what in her inner self she thinks. And this reflects in her action in economic policy and not only in economic policy.
Can you tell us about this referendum coming up and what it means?
Well, this referendum has clearly taken a symbolic meaning. I mean, if you look...
Okay, but before you get into it, can you just explain it for our listeners who haven't been tracking or might not be aware of quite why this is so substantial?
Yeah, I'm not sure that many Italians have understood what the issue really is, because it's a fairly technical issue, and this has to do whether judges and state attorneys should be in the same category or not, whether there should be one single division, and within this division you can have judges and state attorneys, and they can move from one to the other, or whether they are separate, as in many countries in Europe, they are separate, and they are more attached to the government. In Italy, they are totally independent. In some other countries, they will be somehow connected to the Ministry of Justice. So that is the issue on which clever people can have different views. And I mean, you would not be able to conclude that one is totally wrong and the other is totally right. But then this has taken a bit like the experience of the referendum that Renzi eventually lost on changes to the constitution, has taken that's a way for people to vote about Meloni. I mean, she has been, again, clever and more clever than Renzi, because Renzi had said, if I fail the referendum, I will resign. Meloni has clearly said, no, this has nothing to do with me and the government. This is one specific issue, so my life does not depend on that. But people do take it as if it was a vote on her. And then what is the underlying electoral situation in Italy becomes important, because Italy is basically, and Emmanuel can correct me, is practically divided in two. 50% is center-right, 50% is center-left. The big political difference is that the center-right is united, the center-left is divided, and it's not only divided, but it's divided because of some good reasons. For instance, Ukraine. I mean, on the center-left, there are very different views between the Democratic Party and Cinque Stelle. And so you don't know how it would go in the referendum, because if it's 50-50, well, then it's very open to a yes or very open to a no. So this has become a kind of test for the Meloni government, even if she tried to not consolidate this view.
Manuel, is Meloni now a center-right politician?
No, I think it's clearly, given the views she supports, whether internationally by being, let's say, rather sympathetic to some things that Trump puts forward, or also other countries in the world, and by the domestic dimension that Francesco has raised, it's very difficult to describe her as center-right. I think the part of the trouble of in situating her is what we've just discussed before. So that Janus face, Francesco was saying, between a dimension of external relations of Italy, let's put it in that way, that sort of has gained her some degree of respectability, and at the minimum that she wasn't so extreme as we could think she would be on Europe. And the fact that at home she can carry on and also, I think, more subtly support and legitimate a whole part of the population that supports ideas of the far right is clearly going against her as being described as center-right. We shouldn't remember, in addition to what I've mentioned before, the Ventotene Manifesto and her reaction that ran against, I think, a large part of the Italian population's view, the fact that the National Day of the 25th of April is still a point of contention for Meloni. So the 25th of April is celebrating the insurrection of anti-fascist movements to liberate Italy. And Meloni is only describing that as a liberation day. She doesn't acknowledge that it was an anti-fascist movement. Why? Because precisely she's coming from hereditary of the neo-fascist movements. She doesn't want to acknowledge that. And the fact that she doesn't want to acknowledge that clearly, I think, disqualifies her as being center-right.
One way to look at it is what is the position of Meloni's, or Fratelli d'Italia, really, in the European Parliament. And you know that there are three shades of right wing. So beyond the Popular Party, there is ECR. Then there is a Patriot, and then there is a third one whose name I always forget because it's a bit anti-intuitive. So she is on ECR. So the one that is less right than the other two, but is at the right of the Popular Party. And we know that the Popular Party is a big thing, so it can accommodate quite some center-right views and also some center-left views. I mean, Merkel and Merz are different representative of the PPD in Germany. So it's right. It's not as hard right as the Patriots or the other one. And as I said, I mean, she is clever not to be put in a position where her options would be constrained. She wants to have a freedom of movements, and that applies also to the relationship between Europe and the United States. And I mean, this is tactically clever. Whether it is strategically clever remains to be seen. It's, in my view, it's a gamble. She is gambling on keeping this ambivalence between the two.
I recently was reminded that there is no Greek equivalent to Janus, the Roman god of doors, that this is a particularly Roman concept. Of course, also as a reminder that those of us who've not spent significant time in Italy should not try to understand Italian politics without a guide. So thanks to both of you for helping walk me and our listeners through this, because it's so important right now. In the second half of our podcast, I want to talk now about Italy's role in Europe and in keeping the whole thing together. We've seen Italy be supportive of joint borrowing. We've seen Italy be somewhat supportive of working together on defense and other measures that have been very sovereign for a long time. We've also seen Italy, how do I say this? On the one hand, resist having an economic crisis, which has been huge given that we had five countries in the euro area that required support. Yet at the same time, it has flouted some of the reforms that the European Commission has called for. And I'm thinking specifically of the country-specific recommendations, which have been part of the fiscal rules for such a long time. Big picture, they're supposed to look at things like debt-to-GDP ratio, economic growth, unemployment and employment trends, but also they get into things like the beaches and the trash collection in Naples, and they get very, very granular in ways that don't seem to be changing things in Italy and don't always seem to be tied into these higher level goals of managing fiscally. So I guess my question, Francesco, is the European economic governance approach fit for purpose? And if so, what is Italy teaching us about it?
You mentioned Italy's support for common debt. And of course, you should look at the Italian debt situation. And you understand that any government would be in favor of common debt. Indeed, I mean, I would think it would be a terrific thing if there was a government who said, no, 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 for the time being, I want to take care by myself and expressed independence from this idea of common debt, which, by the way, is a very good idea when it comes from a heavily indebted country. And I said before that in flow terms, Italy is better than France, but in stock terms, Italy is much worse than France as yet. We don't know where France will get. So I think on common debt, it's nearly an obligated position for Italy to take, which I don't think that economically would be justified. I mean, Italy has no current account problems. It has enough resources if it would use those resources effectively. I mean, I refer to the fact that Italy hasn't been grown for the last 25 years. Total factor productivity, that is the ability to generate income out of given resources in Italy, is not growing. I mean, there is something fundamentally wrong in the Italian economy, which is not remedied by the Meloni government, as was not remedied, as I said before, by previous government for a very long period. Now, the attitude of Italy towards Europe, I think that given what I said about the difference of Meloni's attitude towards what she can win and what she cannot win, she will concentrate her ideology-driven action domestically. And so she will try and avoid entering into collision with Europe. Still, I mean, she will pursue her ideological views, but domestically, where she knows, I don't know, she's making abortion more difficult. Okay, Europe doesn't have much to say about abortion. She's making other civil rights more difficult now to become Italian. I don't know. You must spend a century in Italy before you can become Italian. And on migration, those are things that she thinks she can fight and win. On fiscal policy and on issues of economic policy that are not directly under European control, because you refer to garbage collection, I refer to the beaches, you refer to other things. Europe has a role, but it's not as strong a role as in fiscal policy. And if you look at what the OECD says about real competition in Italy, competition not on the labor market, but competition on product market, you see that Italy has a long, long way to go before even reaching Germany, which is not considered the most non-bureaucratic country in Europe, leave alone to reach UK or the Scandinavian country or even France. But this is not in the program. You don't see that this is, notwithstanding the hope that there existed with the common lending program. I always thought that the important part of the common borrowing program was not the money that would come to Italy, which was a large amount of money, but the occasion to do this structural reform. Now, we still have to see this structural reform coming to fruition.
Manuel, what do you think of all this?
I like the expression that Francesco has used to describe the position of Italy on joint borrowing, obligated position. Because in a way, many positions of the Italian government in the history of European integration were somehow, you could describe them as obligated positions. I mean by this, ones that you would expect. So joint borrowing is not only something that Italy supports now in the 2020s, it was already something that it supported in the 1970s when the very first instruments for borrowing were created, the new community instrument that was created in 1978. And Italy was a strong supporter at the time, and alongside the Commission and the European Parliament was one of the supporters of having that modest scheme at the time become permanent. It was actually just a few issues of bonds renewed every 3 years, and then that stopped in the late 1980s, but for the three renewals of the schemes every time the Commission, the Parliament and Italy were actually pushing for that to become permanent. And that failed because, as you would expect, other member states had also, inverted commas, obligated positions. And these positions were the positions of the frugals, and they were against that kind of borrowing. But the other thing I had in mind, this is a classic also of Italy and European integration, is supporting cohesion policy or regional policy, especially at its development in the 1970s. Italy was a strong supporter, again, that you can expect, because Italy would have benefited from, or benefited also from regional policy and cohesion policy, partly because of the situation of the Mezzogiorno, the southern regions of Italy, that badly needed an economic push. But then Italy was not alone in supporting that kind of policies. Other countries that also you would expect were interested in that kind of policies, like Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Greece, were supporting that kind of position.
Do you think that Italy's inability to conform with the EU's economic governance framework has said more about Italy or more about the EU or about just the framework generally, that it doesn't work in the way that countries would intend?
I think it says much about both, so with the EU and the country, because interestingly, when Francesco mentioned the country-specific recommendation, when you actually mentioned the country-specific recommendation, that made me think that the very first type of predecessors to the country-specific recommendation took place in 1981, when the Commission made specific recommendations to Italy and to Belgium in two different cases. So in the Belgian case, that was because the budget was not balanced, and so there were different problems in the Belgian economic policy that were worrying the Commission, and so they wrote a note and made a few recommendations about the situation, and then the Belgian government took note of the recommendations. And for Italy, that was different. That was a question of monetary policy that was much more specific and had fiscal implications. But anyway, my point is, these were the first two country-specific recommendations that were made by the Commission in 81, based on a decision that has been that is no longer in force, obviously, that was the convergence decision of 1974. But what is interesting is that the person who pushed for these two specific recommendations that were using in full the Commission's powers at the time was actually an Italian, the head of DG ECFIN, or Economic and Financial Affairs at the time, Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, who was discussing the state of these tools and was complaining about the underuse of the different tools at the disposal, the fact that they were the first time they were used in 1981 while they actually existed since 1974 was actually just telling you that for 7 years they had not been used, and was at the same time criticizing that these recommendations were never really followed. So the recommendation to Belgium was a recommendation, and then the Belgian government took note, and that was all. So that's why I responded at the beginning to your question. I think it tells much about both. It tells much about the unwillingness, the impossibility for different reasons, political, economic, whatever, of the domestic countries, whether it is Italy or actually other member states, to be honest. We shouldn't just be thinking about that in terms of one specific member state. And it tells a lot about the way in which European rules are crafted, whether they identify the relevant indicators, whether they're realistic, whether they're functional, whether whatever, the way in which they are designed. And so I think it's really a question of both parties, just not just one. It's both the member states and the EU level that are at fault in the problems of that kind of economic recommendations.
Rebecca, if you allow me, I would like to raise two issues with Emmanuel. One, which definitely goes into his direction. The other, I mean, we have to discuss whether it goes in the same direction. Maybe I would start with the second one that could be a little more exciting because it could show some disagreement between Emmanuel and me. It's always good. And that is the reflection that, as you said, Emmanuel, Italy managed somehow not to be a crisis country during the European crisis. I mean, Ireland, Spain to some extent, Portugal, Greece, Cyprus, when there, Italy managed to escape that. But if you look what has happened since, in a way, the experience of all these countries, and of course, we have now a chairman of the Eurogroup, which is the Greek finance minister, which is, I mean, the coronation of the recovery of Greece. Italy didn't have that. Italy continued to stagnate. So you get a sense that taken in sufficient doses, Europe can help growth. And the problem with Italy just didn't take enough of a dose of that remedy. So that would put more burden on the national part of the explanation to which Rebecca was alluding. My second comment, which instead goes entirely into your direction, I remember when I was at Banca d'Italia, there was a discussion about creating the European Monetary System, and the European Monetary System had the two parallel. There was a monetary part, and then you will remember the exact name of that, but parallel measures or something.
Concurrent studies.
Yeah. What was needed to help the countries that would no longer freely have the foreign exchange available as a tool of monetary policy. And Italy was a strong proponent of this second part. Germany was a strong proponent of the monetary part. Italy was a strong. And that goes into the direction that Italy consistently acted as a demanding country, even when it had a GDP per head, which was way above the average. Now this is no longer the case, but even when Italy was a net contributor, had a higher GDP per head, was still in that mode of demanding something, support from Europe. So on the second issue, I think you agree. Yes, so that's another case. I wonder what is your position on the first point that maybe would have been good if Italy had also been subject to the Troika.
Actually, interestingly, I think we disagree more on the other than on the first one. So on the Troika, I think one of the main issues is that Italy is a completely different country in the sense that it's much larger than any other one. So it's probably much more difficult to reform and has completely different situations. So I'm not sure I would really change my view that I think it's partly both domestic issue and a question of a problem with EU rule. Where I would perhaps, against what you were expecting, nuance a bit more is in your view of the concurrent studies of the MS, but more broadly on the balance between the monetary part and the economic part. It's true that Italy has always been more on the side of demanding, so increasing budget transfers, increasing the EU budget, borrowing. But at the same time, we must acknowledge once more that the final setup of the euro is clearly imbalanced in one direction, exclusively for the monetary side rather than the economic side. It hasn't had a fully fledged budget, and we are still discussing creating a larger borrowing facility. So here I would tend to say that I wouldn't portray Italy as only on the demanding side as if it was, a bad thing or as if it was wrong. I think we need to acknowledge that the EMU setup is imbalanced in itself. And that's one part of the problem, and which again explains, I think, my view that it has as much to do with the domestic situations of member states as with the EU setup.
Italy is such an interesting benchmark for these questions because of its size and importance and its national characteristics. Every euro crisis mechanism that has been developed or has been put on the shelf at the European Central Bank usually faces a question of, is it big enough to help Italy? Can this be used to help Italy if needed? Yet, also, Italy has not needed. And on the upside, Francesco, you yourself have written that if Italy could somehow fix itself up to improve its fiscal situation, its outstanding stock of debt could even become a safe asset for Europe in idealized circumstances. So I guess my closing question to you is, where are the downsides of Italy and how do we view them alongside these potential upsides?
Well, I think the basic problem beyond the problem of the Meloni government is whether there is a constituency in Italy for doing the necessary structural changes, which would inject competition and a new vibrance in Italy. And it's not clear that this is there. It's not clear as well that Italy is willing to take a little more risk. I see a general problem in Europe that the risk attitude is very limited. The risk tolerance is very limited. But I see this as being particularly strong in Italy. I mean, there is a little problem in Italy, and suddenly the government issues a law to deal with this very little problem that will introduce new constraints, new obligations, and that seems to be both in public life and in private enterprises, little taste for risk. So the absence of a culture of competition and the limited attitude to risk are, to me, the biggest problems in Italy, which require a very strong effort to be remedied. But I don't see this strong effort being deployed as yet.
Manuel, thoughts on the threat and potential offered by this incredibly important country?
On the threats, I would add, I would agree with Francesco. I would perhaps nuance it a little bit in saying that there are some advantages, some strength that Italy has in spite of its economic problems. In particular, it has an industrial base. It is rather strong. And in that sense, we could easily argue, I think, that Italy has much better adapted to the euro than France, for instance. Something that Italy should be aware of and cherish. Even if it could do better, I don't mean otherwise. There are plenty of problems. I don't deny that. But there are also strengths. I think one of the main dangers is the ambivalence, the Janus-faced nature of the Italian government at the moment that we discussed earlier. The fact that on the one hand it seems to be trying to win some sort of respectability, but that at home it has in legal, in domestic policy, in social terms, a policy that is very much inspired and comforting parts of the far right. And that ambivalence is very dangerous because it gives the idea that a government that, again, we can, I think, certainly not describe as center-right, is kind of okay. And we are sleepwalking into accepting that. And I think that is something that we should be aware, and it has consequences, and it's something that we need to be wary of.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. My guests today have been Francesco Papadia and Emmanuel Moulin-Drouolle, both at Bruegel, both authors of really interesting work on the history of the euro area and economic integration and crisis prevention and crisis fighting. And I really thank both of you for moonlighting as Virgil today to help us guide our way through thinking about this very important country that plays such a big role in European politics and the European economy. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You can find this podcast and all of its archives on our website for free, Bruegel.org, and all your favorite podcast platforms. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.